Hello and welcome back to the football podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news. We're back from a short break and we're back with a very special guest, journalist extraordinaire, musician extraordinaire, and most importantly, I think in these troubled times, a ferocious excavator of truth. Welcome back to the transfer window, Philippe Auclair.
Thank you very much, Duncan. I mean, excavator of truth. I'm going to put that on my business card from now on. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for speaking to us again. Among other subjects, we're going to discuss Chelsea, as we have to do this week, Everton, Monaco, and football geopolitics. Philippe is here as a super substitute for Ian McGarry, who in best transfer window podcast tradition is off hunting butterflies. I'm going to start with a bit of exclusive news that that Ian has passed on and passed on before his butterfly sojourn, which is about Carlo Ancelotti's response when he was contacted by Manchester United as part of their search for what they like to describe as a permanent successor to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. We can tell you that that contact was from the new Manchester United chief executive, Richard Arnold. It took place over 2 weeks ago. Ancelotti was told that they were interested in him because they saw him as an experienced, mature leader who is a proven winner of trophies. He has, according to someone close to Carlo, had a long-held ambition to manage Manchester United, and he believes that he could make a difference in the current circumstances. He's not unhappy at Real Madrid at present, but he's also not entirely content. There are several factors here. One is that Ancelotti was approached by Manchester United in the past by Sir Alex Ferguson when Ferguson was looking for successors before his retirement in 2013. He has a strong relationship with Cristiano Ronaldo, an important factor in the current Manchester United. And also, I think, has to be taken into account that his position is now in danger at Real Madrid. I talked to a source at the Spanish club today. He told me that no decision had been made on Ancelotti's future, but it is essential for Florentino Perez that they defeat Paris Saint-Germain, and that Florentino Perez was not happy with the way in which they played the game, not only the result, but the manner in which they played in Paris in the first leg of their Champions League round of 16 game. So that there's a real possibility that Ancelotti might be available without compensation in the summer. Philippe, what do you think about the idea of Ancelotti as the solution to Manchester United's many, many problems?
I find it puzzling, Duncan. Because what it makes me wonder about is why exactly did they get Ralf Rangnick, if indeed they're turning to somebody like Carlo Ancelotti. My generous interpretation of going for Ralf Rangnick was that the club realized that what they needed was a long-term strategy, and that Rangnick could play a double role. One, first of all, to smooth down things, to be a, you know, what the Italians call a ferryman, somebody who can take you to the end of the season on less choppy waters.
Yes.
But also could then become somebody who would give Manchester United the strategic view that has been missing from the club for so long. And he's, you know, obviously very well placed to do such a thing. It is actually, you would say, is USP, the thing at which he's best. And then Rangnick then would turn into some kind of super consultant and help the club put together a long-term project in which, you know, he would draw from his experience with the Red Bull Group and therefore create a new legacy, so to speak. And I thought, actually, you know, that kind of makes sense. And if he's given the possibility of doing that, that actually might work in the longer term, and which is something which Manchester United definitely needs. Now, I cannot see for the life of me how Carlo Ancelotti would, you know, brilliant as he is as a manager, and however much we love him, and we all love him, how he can fit in that kind of strategic long-term view at his age, given his record, given the type of manager he is. Yes, he's a proven trophy winner. What can I say about Carlo Ancelotti that hasn't been said 100 times before? But on the other hand, if you're looking at somebody who is going to try to start a new legacy, as it were, I don't necessarily think that Carlo is the right person for that. And maybe he would be a very successful appointment in the immediate term. But I see that as very paradoxical, because that would go against what I thought was the long-term view behind Ralf Rangnick's appointment. So yeah. I find that a bit difficult to reconcile the two. Now, it is Manchester United, and we know that contradiction has not exactly been absent from the club's life over the last few years. And actually, even before Sir Alex Ferguson decided to leave the club and David Gill decided to leave the club, there were signs that things were not exactly working as they should. But this really surprises me in terms of the logic of it. On the other hand, can I see it happening? Absolutely. But I don't know. Maybe I'm naive, but I thought if Rangnick is coming, it's to put in somebody who is coming from the same kind of school, a younger manager perhaps, who is going to shake up the culture and impose a different type of culture on the club and among the players. And do you think Carlo Ancelotti could do that? He could manage those players, of course. He could get results, yes, of course. But would he be that kind of manager? I don't think so.
I think you pick up on a lot of key points, the apparent illogicality of the move, the paradoxical nature of it. I think you're absolutely correct to say that the idea was that Rangnick would lead a change, and that Rangnick's own idea was that he wouldn't just lead it as a consultant at the end of the season. He was coming in thinking he would continue as manager. That has fallen away because of results, because of the lack of the expected improvement, and because of the response of the players. And something that we've talked in detail on various previous transfer window podcasts about. And I think it is very typical of Manchester United for them to swing from one stated strategy to another. And to also, I think there is an element here, again, something that we've discussed in previous podcasts. You have a new chief executive coming in. He wants this to be his appointment, and he wants to cover the bases. He wants to look at a range of candidates available. He has Maurizio Pochettino pushing very hard to take the job, as he had when Solskjaer was on his way out and Pochettino wasn't able to extract himself from PSG. He has a support that would like Erik ten Hag to come in his place. Decision-making hasn't been Manchester United's strong point since Ferguson's exit. And therefore, you get, I think, these series of illogical and apparently paradoxical decisions. But let's, because we have a lot to fit in this podcast, and there has been a huge amount happening in English football and world football this week, let's move on to Chelsea and the decision of Roman Abramovich to announce that he was selling the club. In a quite incredible few days, on Saturday, we had a statement from Abramovich saying that he was going to hand over stewardship of the club to Chelsea's charitable foundation. By Sunday, the club was having to make a statement on the conflict in Ukraine because of criticism that the Ukraine had not been mentioned in that original statement from Abramovich. There was still no mention of war, no mention of the word invasion, or even any mention of the word Russia, which is interesting given that the Russian government at that time was instructing media organizations in Russia not to use the word war or invasion in the context of what they call a military operation in Ukraine. And then by Wednesday, we have Abramovich announcing that he'd taken a decision to sell the club for what he believed was in the best interest of the club. A statement I think I'll leave you to pick apart in terms of what he said about loans being repaid and what proceeds would come from the sale and where those proceeds would be directed to.
Well, Duncan, I think that clarification has been pretty difficult from the word go as far as these statements have been concerned, because as I'm sure you do, I remember coming across the statement on Saturday and wondering what exactly it meant, what the word stewardship, which I'd never seen used in this context, could possibly mean. Was it a transfer of management capacities? Was it a transfer of ownership? And, you know, pretty clearly it wasn't that. But, and I remember at the time seeking clarification from a few people around the club, and I wasn't getting much further than I did when I first discovered the text. And then it became clear that it was not a transfer of ownership, but it also became clear that the people, the trustees of the foundation itself, and by the way, among these trustees are people like Bruce Buck, who is the has been the chairman of Chelsea Football Club since February 2004, and other people who are deeply involved within the club, like Emma Hayes, for example, whom you would imagine if had been, if not parties to Abramovich's most, you know, confidential briefings, would at least have an idea what was involved in this word stewardship. And very clearly it appeared that, well, in fact, the trustees didn't really know what would be the consequences for them in terms of personal and collective responsibility, accountability, and all these sort of things. Speaking to lawyers and sports lawyers, but lawyers and, you know, business lawyers at the time, the response I got was that stewardship mean pretty next to nothing in legal terms. So there was this lack of clarity, which led, as you know, to the foundation itself distanciating itself from Abramovich's statement, and which is quite extraordinary when you think about it, but which also is indicative of a certain sense of panic, whatever the sleekness of the PR operation might be, but a certain sense of panic. What do we do? Because there's a real threat here that the sanctions which the British government have said would be imposed on close allies of Vladimir Putin, we're going to go from talk to action at some point. Well, or so we think. And so you have to act quickly. And I get the feeling that this was the plan A, was in a way to distanciate and to have the responsibilities put in the hands of the trustees. The trustees obviously are not too keen on it. Then you move the goalpost, as it were. Because suddenly there is no more talk about this foundation, which I think is quite an extraordinary thing, is that within a few days, within what, 96 hours,
yeah,
we've moved from plan A, which is the foundation is going to be given the stewardship and take care of the club. So I'm taking a step back, but in a way I take taking a step back because I want to remain in place. To, no, actually, you know what? I'm not going to remain in place. I want to find a buyer for the club because it's in the best interest of the club and so forth. And then there is no mention of the foundation anymore. And I find that this disappearance, that the fact nobody talks about it, quite extraordinary.
And what you have is a mention of a new charitable foundation, which is yet unnamed, which as yet no public details of, as far as I'm aware, which will receive all net proceeds from the sale as a donation, and the foundation will be for the benefit of all victims of the war in Ukraine.
Which is very, again, you know, noble in tone, but very unclear as to what exactly it means. Does it mean the Ukrainian nation itself, the government, all the infrastructure that is being raised to the ground by Russian bombs at the moment, the people who, families of people who've lost their lives already, the families of those helpless, hapless young Russian soldiers who are also, you know, dying in Ukraine as we speak. It's very unclear. And it's understandable in a way that you cannot be, you know, in the circumstances that we found ourselves in. You cannot possibly ask for something to be cast in, you know, in stone right now. But what we're trying to understand is what exactly it means as far as his own position is, and what also the consequences are for Chelsea Football Club. And this plan B, which is the sale of the club, there are, as you say, many things, many questions, more questions than answers. Because again, yes, the net proceeds is something which I immediately, the word net immediately made me think, well, what is meant by that? On one hand, Roman Abramovich is saying that the money that he loaned to the club, which is 1.5 billion, is not something he's going to ask back from the buyer. Okay. But then how much does he value the club? And the information we're getting, and I think we're getting the same information, Duncan, is that we're looking at a figure between 3 and 3.5 billion pounds, which is a lot of money.
I think here it's important to reference the Swiss billionaire Hans-Jörg Weiss,
yes,
who kind of blew this story into the public domain by saying that Abramovich is trying to sell all of his villas in England. He also wants to get rid of Chelsea quickly. I and three other people received an offer on Tuesday to buy Chelsea from Abramovich. He said the price was £4 billion and that the club owes Abramovich £2 billion, and said he could only do it himself if he was to get involved in a consortium. But he's basically saying there that the asking price that was put to him was £4 billion. Now, in terms of that net proceed line, Abramovich could say, I'm not going to ask for the loans to be repaid, but if his asking price is achieved and that asking price is £4 billion, then that doesn't mean the full £4 billion goes to this foundation. I've queried representatives of Abramovich on this today to ask them what exactly net proceeds meant and received no reply. So it's an open statement, as have many of these statements been. And the question, I think, is who is capable of buying it and what price can be achieved in this fire sale.
Yeah, and the question is how much the club is worth, and which is of course very, very difficult. I mean, you've got things, you've got assets which you can quantify, you've got playing assets, and I think that if you look at the players that they've got on their books, the length of the contracts and so forth, all the things you've got, all the parameters you've got to factor in, you get to about 800 to 900 million pounds in terms of the worth. I mean, the players themselves. Again, these figures, to be absolutely honest, are purely theoretical.
Yes, we should say here on the most recent accounts of Chelsea, i.e. Fordstone Limited, who is the holding company that controls Chelsea, the intangible assets of Chelsea, which are mainly the players, are valued at 437 million, and the tangible fixed assets are 179 million.
Yeah.
I talked to someone who's been involved in transactions and actually was involved in valuing Chelsea when Abramovich had kind of placed it softly on the market after he had his UK visa taken back from him several years ago. And his assessment was that Chelsea is probably worth £2 billion, given that you have a huge problem over the stadium. Given that, for example, Tottenham Hotspur recently received a proposal from an American-based SPAC, which valued their club at $3 billion, including $700 million of debt, so $2.3 billion for the equity. So the idea that he can get $4 billion in this market, which according to Vice is what he was asking for, seems extremely optimistic.
Yeah, and I think one crucial aspect of this, and you touched upon it, is the stadium, which is a problem that Chelsea has been trying to address for a number of years. Remember how they were trying at one point to relocate the club to Battersea Power Station, which, by the way, I thought was an absolutely magnificent idea, but these days are long gone. But at the moment, the capacity, if I'm not mistaken, is just under 42,000. The scope for extending the capacity is extremely limited. So when you're talking 42,000, you're talking about, that's, my goodness, that's 34,000 fewer people than at Old Trafford. It's much smaller than the Emirates. It's much smaller than the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It's smaller than Anfield. it would be smaller than the new Everton football stadium if this football stadium was ever constructed. So we've got a problem here, because also we've got a local authority, Hammersmith and Fulham. I should know, I'm a resident of it, which always looks askance at developments, which, especially in that area, which is a very heavily built residential area, which would actually have a negative impact on that. And the local residents as well are not exactly the easiest to deal with. I think there's a case of one particular resident who is just located by the East Stand, I think, who strenuously refuses to sell his property or their property, because there was a plan, wasn't there, at one point to expand the stadium that way, and they can't do that. There's also the added problem, of course, that the ground itself, the freehold of the ground, is not the property of Chelsea Football Club, but of a different company, which is not controlled by the football club, but by the so-called Chelsea pitch owners, and which is a big problem. So you think, okay, it is a club which has won 19 major trophies, I think, since Roman Abramovich arrived in June 2003. It's very successful. It's got a solid global fan base, even if it's not the equivalent of some of the super clubs. But the scope for expansion are limited, very limited. And that's something to take into account, especially now. And as well, I would imagine that given the situation in which Roman Abramovich finds himself, a quick fire sale, usually a quick fire sale, is not what makes the price go up, is it?
Yeah, I think the question is, can Chelsea survive in the same position of power as a football club with a new owner, given that you have, well, I think we can take Russian oligarchs out of the potential constellation of buyers at present. Mm-hmm. You have someone like Jim Ratcliffe, who I'm told does have the money available, who looked at Chelsea several years ago and made an attempt to buy it before buying Nice in France, and has his own goals in terms of a sporting project. But I don't see someone like Ratcliffe putting what amounts to 1.5 billion over 90 years into the club as funding. You have an American buyer in Ted Boley, who runs a large consolidated investment fund that's said to be worth 7.5 billion. But generally with American buyers, they are looking for profit on their purchases. And I think if this had happened a year ago, then there would be a real serious possibility of a sovereign wealth fund, Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, of taking on Chelsea rather than Newcastle United. But I'm not aware of a nation state buyer who is looking for a club at present and ready to do that kind of deal in the kind of abbreviated timescale that Abramovich seems to have been provoked into making this decision by.
And there's another source of investment which we can more or less discard, which is, of course, coming from the Far East and from China. The bubble and truly burst. We know that the Chinese authorities are not too keen in seeing their own billionaires invest a lot of money outside of the country in foreign football clubs. We've seen a lot of Chinese capital trying to get out of football as it happens. So that's another avenue which is not really open. I mean, the clubs, I think the one thing you would say is, which speaks in favor of it in terms of financial terms, is that the club has certainly done big efforts in the recent past to redress its financial imbalance. Abramovich hasn't had to put as much money as he used to put in it. They've managed to more or less stabilize the finances. They've put in place a very successful youth policy, which has to be applauded, and of which they're reaping the fruits on the field, by the way, which means that they have changed their modus operandi. Nobody doubts that the club is not run. I mean, Marina Granovskaya has a very high reputation, in whether a new owner would be able to keep her is a different matter. But the club is, you know, it's a seductive offer. But again, it's the amount of money that is quoted seems to me quite unreasonable, really. Now, the thing is that the circumstances are what matter. And it might be that there is a point at which something is better than nothing. Even if there are no signs at the moment that the British government is going to act perhaps as decisively as others in this particular field, we shall see. But I've yet to see, for example, I've just read that the yacht of an oligarch was seized in the south of France, in La Ciotat, this afternoon. Not frozen, it was seized by the French customs. And it might be that other measures of that kind will be taken soon. But again, he's got to think about this possibility and the possibility of the conflict, unfortunately, the very likely possibility of the conflict getting even more serious and the sanctions even more severe. So where that leaves the club,
which one of his spokespersons said that Abramovich had been asked to intervene in and that he was doing what he could to help.
Yes, well, I've read this story as well, to be honest. I mean, and I've tried to substantiate it. I haven't found any pictures showing any photographic evidence or film evidence. Yeah. Showing that Roman Abramovich was indeed in Belarus, or I traveled to Belarus, looking at you know, where his private jet has been flying the last few days. There was no sign of a flight to Belarus. There was I think there was one to Moscow not that long ago. And of course, he might very well take another means of transport to go there, but there are no reasons to believe that it might have been his intention to play some kind of role as a go-between, as somebody who would try to initiate a dialogue, but there is absolutely no proof that this has been happening. And I find that actually quite remarkable, the fact that we've taken the communication coming from Mr. Abramovich almost at face value in our media. And I'm not saying he's lying. All I'm saying is that we're talking about somebody who is put in an extraordinarily difficult situation, and he's trying to do whatever he can to extricate himself from this situation, both in terms of reputation, in terms of wealth, and that therefore we should take what he says perhaps with a pinch of salt. It might be a noble intention. Yes, I don't know. Perhaps let's give him the benefit of the doubt. But when it comes to what is actually happening, we've heard about this foundation. It's not happening, quite clearly. We've heard about the peacekeeping or, you know, the mission, the goodwill mission. Well, maybe he's placing calls with some of his friends. After all, he had a close relationship with Vladimir Putin for quite a while. Let's not forget that. That's possible. But we haven't seen anything tangible which showed that that was the case. So it's I find it quite, especially in the current circumstances where everything is so fluid and everything is so difficult to place a judgment on, which is why I'm very, you know, Duncan, you can, I hope it goes across, is that I'm trying to be very careful here, because I'm not saying, because I can't, that this is true, this is untrue. All I'm saying is that it's question after question after question after question, and no clear answers being given. We're in the land of hypothesis and perhaps mirage. And at the moment, it's very difficult to tell what is real, what is not real, what is just an idea, a wish, a vision, and what is actually happening. And I think this uncertainty around him is also an uncertainty which affects Chelsea Football Club, and therefore will probably plays a role in the way that people are going about it. And, you know, prospective buyers are also wondering, if I were a prospective buyer, by the way, I mean, let's just, the land of hypothesis. If I were a prospective buyer, this kind of sale is not done in 24 hours, Duncan. No. It takes a long time to set this up. It takes negotiations, it takes, you know, every due diligence. And who knows where we will be in a week's time? We don't even know where we will be tomorrow.
I think it is fair to say that at least from Abramovich's perspective of his personal wealth and his exposure to criticism, and to pressure that is coming from the Labour Party and others, for him to be sanctioned. The war in the Ukraine is damaging to him. He's placed in a position where you can see a logic for him to try and intervene if it is safe for him to intervene, which is, of course, a question. Do you think it is correct that he should be sanctioned for his, he and other oligarchs should be sanctioned for their involvement and associations with the current Russian state?
I think so, yes. I'm not the only person to think so. Now, this doesn't mean that he was complicit in the invasion of Ukraine. Yep. It doesn't mean that he is a fervent supporter of President Putin's dictatorial rule. And you know, I mean, it is by all means and purpose now in a country where you put children in jail and because they place flour on a memorial, and where you also arrest a survivor of the Leningrad siege because she's demonstrating against the war. Is not a country that deserves to be called other than that, and it's a tragedy. And so you cannot hold him personally responsible. He's not the person asking the jets to bomb Kharkiv and Mariupol and Kyiv. But the fact is that the sanctions are meant to hurt Russia, its economy, and people who are close to the regime. Let's not forget he was the governor of the province of Chukotka. Let's not forget that he became a senator as well of this province. I mean, many people have forgotten that. And he needed, I believe, a special derogation, which came directly from the top of the Kremlin to do that. He was an important player in the bid for Russia 2018.
Yep.
He's met President Putin since then. He's been extremely clever at distanciating himself from the regime, and you know, some others who haven't have paid for it, but he tried, and I think he succeeded in many ways to create a public persona, which is extraordinary for somebody who doesn't speak ever.
Yes.
Which presented him as somehow distant and a different oligarch. But the fact is that is we know where his fortune comes from. It comes from the acquisition of assets, let's use that word, neutral word. In the Yeltsin era, it comes from his relationship at the time with Boris Berezovsky. We know how this finished. So, yes, he's part of it.
Yeah, and I think here we can point listeners to Roman Abramovich's own testimony on the matter. He's a man who virtually never speaks to the media, but he did have to testify in a court case taken against him by Boris Berezovsky. He was sued in the UK for £3 billion in 2012. And he made a very long witness statement in which he details the process of paying Boris Berezovsky over $2.5 billion for access to then Russian President Boris Yeltsin, which enabled him to build his business empire from businesses and shares that had originally been property of the Russian people, the Russian government. As you say, his involvement in Russia, despite this kind of separation he'd built for himself by buying houses in the UK, buying a football club, becoming a very prominent figure. And that has always been described by people who know him well to me as a kind of insurance policy, a way of making him, giving himself a degree of protection from what the Russian state might do. He, by his own testimony in that court case, spent approximately $120 million on the development of Russian football. These things have been described as elements that were requested by the president of Russia, by Putin, in order to improve his position and improve Russia's global standing. So he has a clear past involvement with the Russian state.
And I think we could also direct the listeners who would doubt that to two books, which I think are essential reading about Putin's Russia, which are Putin's Kleptocracy, the Karen Dawisha book, which is absolutely quite extraordinary, in which Mr. Abramovich is named in this context. And of course, Catherine Belton's Putin's People, which is still available, despite we know there was a legal case involving her publisher, HarperCollins, Catherine Belton, and representatives, legal representatives of Mr. Abramovich and three other oligarchs, if I'm not mistaken. The book is still out, can still be read. An out-of-court settlement was reached for something like $1.5 million, the equivalent of. We've got to be very careful about this because we're dealing with people who are extremely, very quick at litigating. So, and you know that in Britain, in England, that is, you've got to be very careful about what you say. I think people can should buy the book anyway, give some royalties to Catherine and her publisher, who can do with them. And read what has been said, which, by the way, is not something that was born out of Catherine Belton's imagination, but direct testimony coming from Pugachev and two other former Russian, I mean, who's called them dignitaries, very highly placed, who made claims about Putin encouraging, shall we say, Roman Abramovich to buy Chelsea at the time in 2003. These are just claims. They have been denied strongly by Mr. Abramovich and his legal counsel. So I believe that these denials are actually have been added to the book.
Yes.
But basically, the fact that there is a link between Putin and Roman Abramovich is something that I think that cannot be doubted. I also very much doubt that you would have seen the leader of the opposition asking that the question about sanctions about Mr. Abramovich in the House of Commons, regardless of parliamentary privilege, but opening is questioning of the Prime Minister by actually naming Mr. Abramovich, to which Boris Johnson replied that he wasn't there to discuss personal cases, I believe was what he said, and that he was also named in a list of 35 oligarchs, which was read using parliamentary privilege by a Liberal Democrat MP at the House of Commons as well. So I don't think there is much doubt about that. People can say, well, is it fair to sanction individuals when it is a regime that is acting the way it is at the moment? You could say, well,
he's caught in the structure of the Russian state. And yes, as I pointed out, if you look at his own testimony of how he made his fortune, it details how he extracted wealth through, he would argue, through an unnecessary fashion at the time. He was doing the only things that were possible to do in order to be a successful businessman. But he extracted wealth from the Russian state. And in that testimony, he talks about how he welcomed Putin's arrival as president to replace Yeltsin, because Putin said that he would bring a degree of enforcement of rules as long as the oligarchs paid their taxes to the Russian state. Al Sharusmanov is one of the other oligarchs who was mentioned in Parliament as an individual who certain people feel should be sanctioned, and certainly the European Union have already enforced sanctions upon him. Now, Usmanov is formerly a sponsor of Everton Football Club, as a sponsor to a huge degree through his company USM Holdings. Someone who has paid £30 million for options, her first option on the naming rights of Bramley Moor Dock Stadium. My understanding was that Everton were bought because Usmanov wanted to extract a degree of revenge on Stan Kroenke for not selling him Arsenal Football Club. We know Usmanov bought a large percentage of shares and tried to take over the club in full. Kroenke refused to do that. I've been told that Usmanov then decided he would buy another English club and turn it into a club who were capable of surpassing Arsenal in a domestic and European football. He used a business associate, Farhad Mashiri, who's the chairman of USM, as the holder of those shares. The project, I think it's safe to say, has been a failure from a football perspective. They've run up over £250 million of losses in their last three accounting years. They are trying to build a new stadium at Bramley Moor Dock. That was, I'm told, originally a £500 million project. The latest estimates on costs, I understand, is £700 million. Tens of millions of pounds have already been put into into the preparation of the site. There is a feeling that Usmanov may use this situation where he is been sanctioned by the European Union, where Everton have suspended, not cancelled, but suspended their sponsorships or commercial sponsorships with the Russian companies USM, Megafon and Yota, who are also subsidiaries of Mashiri Usmanov companies, as a way of extracting himself from the Everton project. So it might not just be Chelsea that is placed for sale as a result of European sanctions and potential UK sanctions on the owners of an English football club. We could also see Everton up for sale.
Yep. And when you value the club, as much as you can see that Chelsea would command a very high price, still, you know, whatever we think of the 3.5 or 4 billion figure that has been quoted, when you look at the club's assets, when you look at the location, Stamford Bridge, when you look at all these things, when you look at the trophies won, you can understand why somebody might be ready to put a lot of money on the table. When it comes to Everton Football Club, I'm afraid that, to be honest, I mean, it looks very, very dark to me. And it was already, as you said, looking pretty dark before that. You would also, I mean, that's a personal sentiment here, but I've also wondered for a long time how this new stadium could really have the transformative effect on the fortunes of the club that people thought it could have, given as well its proximity to a true giant of European and world football.
Yeah.
And you think, I mean, that has been my view from the beginning, thinking what is wrong with being a top eight club? And I just don't understand, why does it have to be a top five or top four or top one club? I don't understand that. When the club is, from the outside, not one that can be brought to that level without the kind of investment that the current owners, or current owner now, because he now controls, I think, Mr. Mashiri, at least 89.4%, I believe, of the shares, simply is not in a position to invest. You know, he's no Sheikh Mansour. He's no Qatar Sports Investment. He's no Roman Abramovich. And if Mr. Usmanov, and, you know, there's absolutely no way that Alisher Usmanov is going to even be able to invest that kind of money. I have to say, you're extremely worried for, you know, this grand old club. And you start wondering about whether it was all a folly, really, some kind of madness
that
over. Because, you know, in terms of the way the club has been run as well, because you could make a case for the fact that Chelsea, dysfunctional as they've been for so long, have thrived on this dysfunctionality. It's taken a lot of money, of course, to make it function in a dysfunctional way, but the trophies have been here. There is a clear way of running that club. There is a structure in place at the club, which is now quite a solid one. And again, there is, I insist on that, the youth policy has borne fruit. I don't see that happening with Everton. I really don't. And it saddens me. I love that club. But what I'm seeing right now is, I mean, it's very dark horizon, really.
I think the problem is the investment has already gone in and it's been misspent in terms of the playing squad.
Yeah.
Potentially, the money that goes towards the stadium so far may end up being a project that cannot be completed. where you, so you therefore have more misspent money. And because of financial fair play rules in European football and domestic football, although they are currently suspended because of COVID, the firepower for a next owner, if the club is sold, becomes extremely limited, because the losses have already been run up. It's the kind of polar opposite position to Newcastle United, where Mike Ashley's leadership of the club was so parsimonious and so bottom line oriented that Saudi Arabia, Amanda Staveley and the Rubin brothers have the capacity to put a lot of money in early without breaking domestic financial fair play rules, which gives them a platform in which to try and emulate the Manchester City model of building a club, which is very much their goal and something something that Amanda Staveley has talked about publicly. A story we broke on the podcast very early in the takeover of Newcastle United was that they aimed to be a competitor for the Champions League and the Premier League within 5 years. You see Amanda Staveley and Mehrdad Gudusi, her husband, putting that on record in the past week.
It's not the kind of discourse you're going to hear from Everton, I think.
It's not. And I think the word you used, folly, is an important one there. And I think people who are familiar with the purchase process and the strategy that was engaged in, the motivations of the people involved, the frustrations not being able to buy Arsenal, which is a club that Usmanov supported, and the focus on outdoing Arsenal at another English club has resulted through a number of very bad football and strategic decisions in the situation where they're now in danger of relegation and have had to suspend the companies which provide them with the majority of their commercial revenue that was increased by over 100% in the last club accounts, and predominantly as a result of those options that were bought by USM to have naming rights on the new stadium.
That feels a bit like what is called a rug pull, isn't it? And then suddenly, when the rug is pulled from beneath your feet, and the impact this will have as well, and the people on the people who are working at the club at the moment, which is the other thing that we haven't talked about at all, there's going to be an impact, and you can't avoid it on the fans, but also on the players, on the management, on the whole hierarchy of the club, and that is unquantifiable. And again, we're talking at the moment when, to be honest, there's hardly this crisis really exploded only a few days ago. We really don't know where we're going to go. And at the moment, the uncertainty around what's happening in both clubs, my goodness, lets you think that it's going to get far, far worse before it can get any better. Tragically, there. Less tragically, but still importantly for many people, here as well, both in Chelsea, but especially at Everton.
Yes, and that's, you could say from Abramovich is talking about the interests of Chelsea and the interests of the club and the supporters, that there is a perspective in which if you delete this promise to put the net proceeds into a charitable foundation that perhaps Abramovich himself controls, the way in which you would strengthen the position of the club in these circumstances is to sell for the least amount possible. That would allow the new owners to put more money into maintaining Chelsea's spending at the level that has been achieved under Abramovich.
Yes, because again, this the magical owner doesn't really exist. You can't see anybody jumping in at the moment. There's no sovereign fund I can think of who could jump in. We're probably going to hear some very strange rumors linking the club to some mysterious investors from mysterious provenances, but we can't think of
UFC fighters, retired UFC fighters, for example.
Yeah, things like that. And Yeah. So, it doesn't all go well. And to be honest, at the moment, when the communication at the moment is, we've got to keep thinking about it, is that what we're seeing now is not just business decisions, which are made public. What is happening now is a public relations exercise. We should never forget that, which is crucial. Because, you know, you have, when you have so many interests, such a huge part of your fortune, even if you've stashed a few things away in assets, which can conceivably be frozen or worst, seized by the countries in which they're based, well, you're going to try everything you can to present yourself as somebody who really is not to blame for what is going on. And again, you know, it's not Roman Abramovich who's ordered troops to enter Ukraine. That's not what anybody's saying. The problem is that his links to the regime are such that any meaningful sanctions against this regime would include people like Roman Abramovich and Alisher Usmanov and many others.
You talk about public relations exercise. Let's move on to an organization which I think you've excavated more truth about than probably any other journalist out there, which is FIFA. And their response to what happened in the Ukraine, their initial slow response and then their rapidly adjusted response.
Semi-rapidly. It was rapid in slow motion. The remarkable thing was, and it's not the first time, FIFA is a very slow juggernaut. But you've got some bodies are like those massive tankers which take ages to change direction. But then when they've changed direction, they go on and they go on their way and in a very, you know, determined fashion, which is, for example, what the European Union has done, which was kind of slow, but not really slow compared to what happened usually. But it's a huge tanker and it's going in direction and that's it. It's very clear. When it comes to FIFA, we have to remember that to start with, there was absolutely no condemnation from FIFA. There was just an expression of regret at the tragedy and the human cost, and of course, fine sentiments shared by all of us. But there was, again, this constant mantra of football is the sport that unites us all. You know, the usual, I was going to say rubbish. It's not rubbish because it's true, but when it's used like that, it becomes rubbish, which is dreadful. When you empty words which are so important and mean so much to actually so many people, when you empty them of their true signification, you're not serving your sport very well, to say the least.
When you're talking, for example, about biennial World Cups helping with the migration crisis, yes. In Africa.
I don't think we need to come back on that. That was a disgraceful moment. But in this particular case, you have to remember that it started, you know, first of all, we had the Polish, the Czech, and the Swedish FAs saying, no way, we're not playing against those guys.
Yeah.
That's it. We're not going to play. And then more federations and member associations started to, you know, were waiting for leadership here, but the leadership didn't come from FIFA. And it didn't come from UEFA either. We shouldn't, you know, suddenly think that UEFA is, again, the nice guy in this. UEFA also dragged its feet. And then you realize that the England, Wales, and amazingly, Switzerland, I never thought I would live to see that. Switzerland asked for the suspension of the Russian Football Union. Switzerland, before FIFA even mentioned the possibility of that. And then the statement, and I might have missed something and I might be unfair, but I don't think I missed anything and I don't think I'm being unfair. The statement started that FIFA reiterated its condemnation of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. It had never said anything of the kind in those words. It was rewriting its own history. And it took huge pressure as well from FIFPro to convince FIFA to finally take the decision that the huge majority of the member associations were asking them to take. And I there was one point, actually, when I thought that the pressure was such that it was not just endangering the loyalty or that Gianni Infantino benefits from in the member associations. I thought it was actually starting to endanger his actual rule. He couldn't carry on like that.
Really? Because that's quite a statement, really, Philippe.
Well, I say that because I have talked, as you can imagine, with quite a few people from member associations, football associations and so forth, from various places, not just mm-hmm. Europe. And the feeling I got were people really, really, I mean, you have to come back, first of all, to the fact that he has lost the support of the 54 nations, well, which compose the African Confederation. First of all, by forcing his own president, Patrice Motsepe, in the circumstances which have been, you know, related in great detail. And I've certainly done a lot of work on it for Yozimar, but also these remarks about migrants crossing the Mediterranean were just completely unacceptable, and they were unacceptable. You can imagine how they went down on the African continent, where FIFA is now seen as a colonizer, a neo-colonizer, an imperialist power.
Yeah, and I should refer our listeners to Philippe's articles on this, because basically Gianni Infantino has taken control of the African Federation. It's quite a remarkable state of affairs, and Philippe has detailed that in a number of articles, which, yes, if you're interested, please read.
Yeah, and he has lost a lot of support there, and it's a continent that was very important to him when he was elected, and we'll see what the consequences of this are. When it comes to the reaction to the invasion of Ukraine, the fact that it was so slow eroded even more the little respectability. I mean, did huge
slow and conservative, because the initial response was, you can carry on playing. You're not allowed to call yourself Russia. You're not allowed to have a Russian anthem, but you will be the Russian Football Union.
Yeah, the kind you of charade that we had from the IOC.
Exactly.
So, which is quite extraordinary, really. And this, I genuinely thought when speaking to people from various organizations and member associations, that a number of them really had enough. They had enough. And that they, it's a very, you know, people, as long as suppose you get what you want from a regime, you tend to forget who is in charge and how power is exercised. I think there is a tendency for that. If I get my money, I'll just forget about the rest. But all these things that in French we say, all the snakes you've swallowed in the past, suddenly they taste a bit different in the light of what is going on. And the fact is, it's not just Gianni Infantino, by the way. Sepp Blatter was the same. The FIFA hierarchy has always loved being in, very close to tyrants, strong men, always men. When you entered Sepp Blatter's office in Zurich, it was basically just photographs of him with powerful people and decorations and medals he'd received, just like Gianni Infantino was decorated from the Order of Friendship by Vladimir Putin, which is, by the way, his profile picture on Wikipedia at the moment, which I find is quite interesting. But anyway, this kind of complicity with strong power, which has been a hallmark of the way FIFA operates, is something that I think more and more people are getting very uncomfortable with. And it's not just football fans like you and me. It's not just people who can't stand what's happened to FIFA and don't like the way football is run. It's also people who are in member associations and FAs who really have had enough. And I thought if he hadn't finally decided to get the FIFA tanker to change direction, he would have got into serious trouble. And I can tell you that, you know, honestly, this is not something I'm making up.
I'm sure you're not, Philippe, with your connections.
I'm not making it up, and I'm very interested to see how he's going to play up in the longer term in terms of the opposition to the way he's ruling FIFA. We know that there is at the moment this massive chasm between, on one hand, FIFA, and on the other, CONMEBOL, South American Confederation, and UEFA. We know how UEFA and CONMEBOL have signed an agreement of cooperation, which means that South American countries can take part in the Nations League and things like that, which is basically almost like a parallel World Cup with only the best teams. And you could see very quickly, I mean, FIFA, let's not forget, FIFA is nothing without its member organizations. Its power is entirely derived from the fact that it says, we are the governing body of football. If people turn away and say, you know what, you're not, they're in trouble. And it's something which has been at the back, to be honest, of the premise of football governance for a while, and is coming to a head now because of everything else, the Club World Cup project, the European Super League, the African Super League, the tensions between UEFA and FIFA, FIFA seeing the UEFA Champions League as something which, you know, if it could be less, if they could crush it, they would crush it. And you could carry on like that. And so we are at the stage where you could feel that the rift that exists could widen into something more than that. And again, it's something which I've talked about with a number of people, number of stakeholders. Certainly the biennial World Cup project, which FIFA hasn't given up yet, is something that is deeply, deeply wounding and resented by a number of people, and more openly, to the point that you could imagine a situation in which you have countries deciding, you know what, we're not going to take part in it. I know it sounds crazy. I mean, how could it happen? Well, I tell you what, it could happen. Because one more time, FIFA only means something. FIFA is the World Cup. That's how it exists. Financially, that's the World Cup. FIFA exists because there are 211 member associations which take part in the qualifications, and some of them in the final tournament. That's, without those member associations behind it, FIFA is nothing. And it cannot go on being the financier of world football, the governing body of world football, the supreme tribunal of world football, the maker of laws, the police, it is everything to everything, and which just cannot work. And you will also see, and I know I'm going on, and by all means, just make me shut up, and please, guys, just fast forward. But what you can see, for example, at the moment, what's happening in Zimbabwe with FIFA. Well, Zimbabwe, the federation, has basically been put aside by the authorities there for one simple reason. They are totally corrupt. They've tried to hush up an absolutely appalling sexual abuse scandal. Loads of people are involved in that. And the Zimbabwean authorities have decided, quite rightly, that the people who had broken Zimbabwean law in terms of corruption and so forth should be set aside, and have put in place a committee which is trying to sort out what on earth this federation. What has the response of FIFA been? Threatening the Zimbabwean authorities, basically putting its own authority above the laws of the country of Zimbabwe, just like they did in Trinidad and Tobago, which is an absolutely scandalous story, which I've written on about as well, where basically they substitute themselves to the rule of the land. Now, you can only go so far, and you can try that perhaps with countries which do not have the political weight to do something meaningful and powerful about it, apart from going to CAS if they can, because it costs a lot of money. And then, you know, so we impose normalization committee here. We prevent these people in Zimbabwe or in Trinidad and Tobago or in Kenya from doing their job. And we do that. We can do it. And FIFA, and this is part of Gianni Infantino's rule. And it's a part of his rule, which is actually much more in evidence than it was in the time of Sepp Blatter. Sepp Blatter didn't room like that.
I agree. And I think it's important to highlight in a podcast where we're talking about the influence of geopolitics on football. It's important to highlight that you have an organization who had the last World Cup in Russia 4 years after Crimea was taken by the Russian state, have the next World Cup in Qatar. Then you have FIFA, as you say, trying to get control of a Champions League, trying to usurp the UEFA Champions League and put their own competition in place. And one of the entities they were involved with in terms of financing that, Saudi Arabia, before they buy Newcastle United. It is a repeating theme which has become fundamental to the shape of football. And so to wrap up the podcast, we'll go to the hero and villain section. And my villain of the week, and one where there is a panoply of options, is Qatar. And why Qatar? Because Qatar have chosen to make an offer to Kylian Mbappe of a 2-year contract, because it is fundamental to Qatar that they want to keep Mbappe as a Paris Saint-Germain employee with Lionel Messi and Neymar for the World Cup in this winter. They've offered a 2-year contract worth, I understand, 50 million euros net per year, with 100 million euro net signing on fee. I'm told that Emmanuel Macron, the current president of France, and Nicolas Sarkozy, former president of France, have also been working on convincing Mbappe to stay in France. Sarkozy has very clear links with Qatar from his period as president. If you ask Leonardo, the sports director, about these numbers, he'll tell you that this is his quote: "We haven't set a precise offer. There is one important element. I think the last thing we will put on this contract will be the amount." Anyone who believes that, I think, is probably slightly too credible in the way that Qatar have operated as an organization, a nation that has secured a World Cup and created one of the most powerful football teams in European football. Mm.
So that's your villain.
That's my villain. Who do you choose as a hero, Philippe?
Well, hero is perhaps too strong a word, but I was cheered in those very dark times by seeing two members of parliament stand up and speak in the House of Commons in a way that I thought was thoroughly encouraging. And I'm talking about Liberal Democrat MP Leila Moran, who used her parliamentary privilege to name 35 oligarchs which are identified as being part of the Putin sphere of influence, let's put it that way. The names are available everywhere. You can look at them. Many of them will be very familiar. And actually, I think a couple of them were mentioned in this podcast. And the other is Bob Seeley, who is a Conservative MP for the Isle of Wight, and who spoke very forcefully about something which is absolutely crucial, and crucial to us journalists, and I think, but also to you who listen to what we say and read what we write and exchange opinions with us. He named some of the British lawyers who have been acting as the dogs of war, so to speak, for these Russian oligarchs, preventing us journalists from doing our job by threatening us with legal actions. And I know that the legal action, you shouldn't threaten with legal action, because we don't know what's going to happen in a tribunal. So it's not a threat. But the threat is that of financial costs. There is absolutely no way independent journalists, small publishers, websites can actually fight these people in court. And they have got millions and millions. And the problem is that the English legal system is such, the libel laws are so strict, that we are prevented from doing our work properly, and that people who fall on the wrong side of those oligarchs are suddenly attacked by those British lawyers who, you know, make millions out of the money of out of the pockets of those billionaires and those kleptocrats, and prevent us from telling the truth. And it was very encouraging to hear a member of parliament, especially coming from the conservative benches, speak up and name those lawyers again. Look it up. You will see who they are. Some names will surprise you because there are people whom you might see associated with good causes, but believe me, this is where they make their money. And, you know, I think it's Nick Cohen of The Observer wrote a piece in which he explained that if you defend a libel action in France, it will cost you something like £10,000. If you defend a libel action in Britain, it can cost you like 1.5 million. So therefore, this is how you muzzle the press. This is how you muzzle the media. And so don't be too hard sometimes, dear listeners, when you hear journalists being very careful, as we are trying to be, believe me, and not saying absolutely everything they know, and even they know for sure, because we know there's this threat. That's one of the reasons, Duncan, why I work with Josimar. We are Norwegian, and yes. So therefore Norwegian laws apply to us. We never print things which are defamatory or libelous. We try to print the truth. But we can do this in relative security, knowing that we would be defended by the Norwegian legal system. When it comes to England, I'm speaking from experience, and I'm sure, Duncan, you must have been in this situation so often, where some great stories that we thought would have shone a light on what is happening in the world of football, naming names, have been prevented from being published by our own lawyers, saying if we do that, they're going to sue us and we just don't have the means to fight against them. So well done, Lana Moran. Well done, Bob Seeley, for taking the side of truth and in the model of all parliaments.
There's a report by the Chatham House organization called The UK's Kleptocracy Problem, How Servicing Post-Soviet Elites Weakens the Rule of Law, published in last December. If you're interested in the detail of some of the things that Philippe is talking about and many other aspects of what we talked in the podcast, I think that gives you a very precise and worrying account of the problems the UK has with Russian and other wealth being, I think, ushered in for a long period into the country. But thank you, Philippe. I really appreciate your contribution today. And we will hopefully have you on the Transfer Window podcast again before too long.
Yeah, and we didn't even have time to talk about the extraordinary case of AS Monaco and its Dmitry Rybolov left, but I'm sure that's a story that will run and run, unfortunately, and we might come back to that.
Well, those links, as a teaser to our listeners, those links to Donald Trump are fascinating.
Indeed, they are.
That was the news before it became news. You can follow us via multiple social media channels on @TransferPodcast. I'm @DuncanCastles and Philippe is @PhillippeAuclair. Please rate, review and share the podcast. The next edition of the Transfer Window will be with you soon.